Hello and welcome to Making Sense. I'm Somnath Batabial, and my guest today is Professor Andrea Cornwall, Pro Director Research at SOAS. Andrea is an anthropologist and has written prolifically on issues of gender and development. Today's conversation is about big data and the relevance of anthropology, on how anthropologists can move beyond the empirical and towards the philosophical. We talk about Andrea's own writing and also the problematic nature of teaching development in universities of the global north. And finally, we talk of love stories. I hope you enjoy the show. Andrea Cornwall, welcome to Making Sense. I'm so glad you're here finally.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Andrea, you must be so happy with the ref results. You were the research director for SOAS, and SOAS has performed so brilliantly.
It was absolutely wonderful. It's a big collective effort, right the way through, from academics producing the research, working with partners in other countries and the impact that they do, but also professional services working to help to make it happen. So it's really fantastic just to see that big collective team effort and coming together in what were possibly the worst and most difficult circumstances that you could possibly wish for.
Yeah, for any of our listeners who still doesn't know, more than half of the disciplines taught at SOAS are now in the top 10 in UK universities. The impact of disciplines like law, music and anthropology have been particularly remarkable. And Andrea Cornwall was our research director through this period. Andrea, before we start, there will be three clear sections I'd like to talk to you about. One is us as anthropologists and how we look at ourselves in this era of AI, ubiquitous AI. Then I'd like to talk to you about your teaching, my teaching, and of course, your career as a writer. To start with, anthropology. We are both anthropologists. You work on gender and development. I work on media, especially in the Global South. Now, as anthropologists, once upon a time, we used to go to different countries. You went to Nigeria, you went to Zimbabwe, I went back to India to gather data. We almost thought of ourselves as empiricists, as something I'll come back to later. But today, the World Wide Web is the biggest repository of human footprints. Data is everywhere. Here is the conundrum. In the pre-Malinowski days, you had colonial officers, you had missionaries, you had curious travelers bringing back data, and then you had armchair anthropologists analyzing that data and coming to all sorts of ridiculous conclusions just because they couldn't contextualize it. Today, the consequences of decontextualized analysis seems to be even more because it affects government, it affects our judiciary. You just see data being analyzed in Silicon Valley in places which has no context to where the data has been generated from. Smart anthropologists have joined Google, but academia seems to be very far behind. Is there a way that anthropologists can reinvent themselves almost in this age of so much data?
That's a very interesting question.
And a long one.
Yeah, and a long and interesting and complex question. I think there are lots of layers to it. And so thinking about some of the layers. So one of the things as an anthropologist is that we count the authenticity of our knowledge is counted from being there, being with people, hanging out. But hanging out online and hanging out with communities online is just the same as hanging out with people in person in terms of being a source of potential data. It's different in terms of our experience of it. But the internet and these other online media provide us with a field, and the field can be accessed from our houses, from our rooms. During the COVID pandemic, we saw that we could access work and that work was able to carry on because we were able to use the internet. About 10 years ago, I did a research project which was entirely online. And it was just following ideas through different domains, engaging with different online communities. And I was really intrigued and fascinated by the possibility of doing this kind of research. I think, as you say now, the explosion of forms of data and just the enormity of it creates other possibilities for anthropologists. So, for example, we might do inquiries into the way certain words have been used, using data mining to be able to then generate massive counts of how these words have been processed in a few nanoseconds, looking at Twitter feeds and using those kinds of technologies to be able to understand how discourses are shaped. That's the kind of thing that anthropologists might have done in the old days by sitting in meetings and making field notes. So I think it's potentially the possibilities of big data can aid anthropological inquiry. I'm not sure it changes the basic thing of what anthropologists do, because anthropologists seek, I think, to be interpreters between different worlds and to take from different ways of framing knowledge, different ways of thinking about the world, an understanding of what it means to be human in all its complexity. So in this new era with all this data, the quest is still the same, to understand what it is that makes us human and what we share in terms of our humanity.
Okay, this brings me to the second point. Now, I was mentioning the role that anthropologists have assumed as empiricists. Now, Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, this great Brazilian anthropologist I'm really admiring, in this fascinating work, Cannibal Metaphysics, for a Post-Structural Anthropology, he asks this of us: can anthropology not reinvent philosophy through a constructive, speculative metaphysics? And what would that philosophy look like whose best instances never abandon Western categories? So what he's asking is, what happens when we take indigenous metaphysics seriously? Our colleague and fellow anthropologist and AI enthusiast Matti Pohjonen asks a very pertinent question. He says, the long lineage of critical anthropological tradition of investigating esoteric categories, such as indigenous metaphysics, has come back full circle. What are some of the metaphysical presuppositions that are embedded into the increasingly ubiquitous use of computational methods and large-scale data sets across all domains of society? What new epistemologies can we discover from the new developments in AI and other experimental technologies of the future? So, in this age of abundant data, can anthropology reinvigorate philosophy with what Latour has termed empirical metaphysics and help philosophy perhaps become truly decolonized?
I think absolutely.
That's a short answer to a very long question again.
But I think, you know, the newness of some of this thinking, so the so-called ontological turn, there's much thinking that predates some of this, thinking anthropologists engaging with philosophers, engaging with particularly the American pragmatists, Quine, engaging with Nelson Goodman. I remember reading Nelson Goodman as an undergraduate student here in the early 90s, and his idea that a version is right and a truth is true for a world it fits, and there being a multiplicity of possible worlds in which truths can be true and versions can be right. And this multiplicity of worlds is magnified by all of this data and all of the multiple domains in which the data is being generated from. So the complexity is there. But again, coming back to my earlier point, I think an anthropologist's task is still the anthropologist's task in relation to that. So the ways in which anthropologists navigate the conceptual universe and act as interpreters of different universes or different worlds, or creating versions that are right for different worlds, is effectively, I think, what you're trying to get at with that question.
What I'm trying to get at, Andrea, is what happens when we take indigenous cultures very seriously for their own categories instead of reinterpreting them with our Western categories of understanding and analysis. So this is where, do you think that the way the AI will be used in the global South in different ways, different spheres, allows us perhaps for a possibility of a new, decolonizing AI studies? Is that kind of something which anthropologists need to think about?
Again, I would argue that anthropologists have always been interested in other ways of viewing, seeing and understanding the world, alternative conceptual universes, alternative metaphysical understandings of other cultures. That's been the work of anthropology for more than 100 years. So I'm not sure that it's new. I think what's interesting is the domain. The ways in which data is now being produced is very different to the kind of ways in which anthropologists went about looking at alternative meanings, trying to make sense of things. I think part of the task of anthropology has always been an understanding of difference. The ways in which anthropologists have gone about it and why they've been doing it is something that's been shot through with a lot of colonial purposes, with a lot of colonial understandings. And I think the decolonizing of anthropology in that regard, which is about power, it's about who's the participant, who's the observer, how are anthropologists conveying these other cultures in their writing. there's a whole field of critique of that. And I think anthropology is grappling with that and taking that really seriously. Mapping it over to AI, again, I don't see why an anthropology of AI would be any different to an anthropology of anything else in the now. Because those critiques come through into every branch of anthropology. And they're fundamentally about what anthropology is for. And I think, again, the question then would be, what would an anthropology of AI be for? What would be its moral purpose? What would be its political implications? And that decolonizing of the study of AI by anthropologists would need to also accompany that, because that's part of how we think about knowledge now.
I think that's a good place to end this part of the conversation, that there's a moral and political purpose to anthropology always. And that's perhaps reinvigorating in this day and age of ubiquitous data. I'm going to move on from this to our teaching, right? You have taught a BA degree in international development at Sussex. At SOAS, I teach a degree in media and development. In an article of yours, you discuss the possibilities of decolonizing development, and you write about your first day of teaching the degree. You enter the lecture hall, and there's a sea of white faces, all eager to go and save the world. And you make it your mission in 10 lectures to dissuade as many as you possibly can from going out and saving the world. Now, I find the same problem with media and development teaching here at SOAS today, that you're trying and dissuading people from going out what they have come here for. This is also in a context, though, that today's students pay many thousands of pounds to come and learn something and then find a job and go and perform and earn the money back. And the people who come from different backgrounds. I remember a time when I was finishing my master's degree here. And after I finished my degree, my professor came up and shook my hand and said, "Som, now you can critique the Nehruvian Empire and you can critique the neoliberal India. You're perfectly unemployable." And he meant it as kudos for me. And I took it as his congratulatory message. But I find that it's increasingly difficult to tell students that they perhaps shouldn't be going back to jobs they intended to go when they first come here. How do you think a very critical approach to such disciplines as development works in this neoliberal education system that we have?
Your questions are very complex. Just an amendment to your framing of what I was doing. I wasn't seeking to dissuade all of these young people from saving the world. I think it's brilliant that they came to university and they had a desire to change the world. I think that's fantastic. That's what university is for, in lots of ways, to my mind. One of the things universities are for. I was seeking to try to dissuade white young people from going out and saving Africans, from seeing Africans and Indians as objects of their pity and objects of their rescue. That's what I was concerned with. And I was particularly concerned with the way in which development is presented to UK publics by the marketing of development agencies and charities in the UK as a rescue project, as poor little Dyer needs a friend. People are suffering, you can help. The idea for white people that they can go and help by joining an NGO or starting an NGO or going out to work in the field in development is deeply problematic on so many levels. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't do that work, but I think they need to do their homework before they do that work. They need to understand about the history of slavery. They need to understand the history of colonialism. They need to understand their own place in their own society in terms of where Britain sits in relation to its relations with the rest of the world and the impact of Britain's policies, trade policies, other kinds of policies, immigration policies on shaping inequalities in the rest of the world. So my mission was not to dissuade anybody from wanting to save the world. It was saying, if you want to go out and work for one of these agencies, there are things that you need to know and you need to ask of yourself. One of the things I wanted the students to understand was about the political economy of aid, of how aid is represented as saving people, but actually a lot of the money that's spent is coming back into this country and large amounts of money being spent on the big accountancy companies. A lot of money spent just simply by counting an accountancy. I wanted people to understand how much aid is given for military purposes, for geopolitical purposes. So that was part of it. I wanted them to look at how celebrities are used to market aid and to question that and to question what's being marketed. I wanted them to think about racism and how racism in our own society is perpetuated through images of charitable white people and people who are in need of pity, in need of help, brown and black people who are from faraway places. So that's what I was questioning and challenging. And I counted amongst my successes the students who came and said, well, I wanted to go and work for a charity and now I've decided to go and work as a youth worker in South London, or I thought I wanted to, you know, work in this world and now I've decided that actually I'm more interested in campaigning or I'm more interested in running for political office. Because I wanted to get an opportunity for them to think about multiple pathways of change and about themselves as change agents in their own society. And that the change that needs to happen in this country, for this country to cause less damage to the rest of the world, to be less part of all the inequalities, climate crises and everything happening other places, and that the urgency of us turning attention to ourselves rather than rushing off to go and save people in other places.
Now I'm going to come to your own work, Andrea, which I've been reading for a while now. In Sexualities and Development, you write that the colonial categorization provided the normative categories of good and bad women. Sex workers are often the original bad women. And you have spoken to me in our morning walks in Yorkshire when we went off for a writing retreat. You told me about your work with sex workers in India and the amazing series of stories that you mentioned, this love stories of sex workers. For our audience, would you want to recollect a few of them here?
Absolutely. So I was involved in making a film, and the film was called Save Us from Saviors. And the purpose of the film was along the lines of what I said earlier on about the rescue industry and about sort of pity and so on, was to look at the work of a sex worker collective who were collectivising to save themselves and save themselves from hassle from the police and from kind of low-life figures in their neighbourhoods, and also from the rescue industry, who were coming, raiding, perpetuating human rights abuses, inviting the police into that as well, who were causing harm rather than causing help. Out of those conversations for the film came some really fascinating stories with women teasing each other about their master, their malak, as they used the word. And the word malak, which also meant lover, which also was the men in their lives. And so the women were telling me about these men in their lives in a completely different way to the way in which the pimp and the sex worker's client are usually represented. They're represented as having all the power. The sex worker is powerless. These nasty men do terrible things. The women are unable to exercise any agency in the traditional narrative. The women are trafficked, they're passive, they're not actively participating in sex work. But I met these women who were really empowered. If their lover behaved in a way that they, you know, if they were abusive to them or they did anything they didn't want, they'd just get rid of them and get another one. The men in their lives were tremendously, the ones that they had these relationships with were often very, very caring, wanted to be able to show care in a way that traditional masculinities available to them in their domestic setups didn't enable them to do. So I became really interested in this. And I thought, actually, there's something quite powerful as a set of stories, both about love and about the power of love in those kinds of contexts, because love is never seen. We only see disease and violence and negative parts of people's lives. So you say to somebody, tell me your love stories. It's completely different to tell me the story of all the bad things that ever happened to you because you're a sex worker. So there's a piece there. But also there's something really fascinating about the play of power, of patriarchy, of masculinity, of femininity, of gender, of all of this stuff in those relationships, because they are not the ways in which they're represented in the Western media. Women had a lot of power in those relationships. They had a lot of agency in those relationships. And there was a lot of care in those relationships. And that's what those stories represent. And so we gathered the stories, and until now, nothing much has happened to them. And so something that I want to do now is to work again with the people I worked with in India and to put together those stories as creative nonfiction. So not as an academic account, but actually as a living account that people can read and then think, okay, the complexity of that person's story, that might do something to change my prejudices and to make me feel and think a little bit differently about this. and to respect the power of those women and the power that comes through independence and earning your own money and being able to draw down, you know, to put your own rules about how your relationship runs in a way that I think a lot of the women, the sort of middle class white woman who might read about this in a newspaper may not have in their own relationships.
You framed it as a serious academic would. Now, would you tell me a few of the stories themselves?
There are so many stories. One, for example, of a woman who told of her lover who would wait up until 1:30 in the morning till she came back from having done her sex work. And he would have hot water waiting for her. He would bathe her. He would feed her. He would make sure that she was completely comfortable. And he was to give her so much care and love. He would comb her hair for her. And he said that in his life, he was not able to do this with his wife when he'd been married, that it was, as a man, it was very difficult for him to perform acts of caring of that kind. But it made him deeply satisfied to do that. He loved the love of caring. So that's one of the stories. Another story of a woman, she crosses the road, the guy stops on his bicycle and he's so completely smitten with her and they fall madly in love. And they have a similar kind of relationship. You know, he cooks for her. He looks after her. He loves looking after her. She carries on going out for work, to work. But the specialness of their relationship is in the ordinary. It's in the everyday. And the ways in which they can work around those gender roles, which would otherwise be very sharply, circumscribed. So a lot of the stories actually were about acts of tenderness, small everyday acts, and the ways in which people make relationships in really difficult circumstances. One of the most memorable stories was a woman who the young man had been coming to her as a sex worker before he was married. The family married the man off to a woman who he was had an arranged marriage with. And he didn't want to have sex with her. He was in love with the sex worker. And this carried on. He kept on coming to the sex worker. And eventually she said to him, "I'm not going to sleep with you until you have sex with your wife. Because that woman has been married to you. And if she doesn't produce a child, that's going to be her life over. She has to be able to have children. She's a domestic woman. These are the things that the woman needs. And so I want you to go and to do that. And don't come back to me until you've given that woman a child." And so sometimes the feelings of care for the women in the men's lives, in the conventional setup, where in a marital setup, women don't have much agency. In a marital setup, women can also experience a lot of abuse. And the sex workers seeing those women and feeling pity for them, but also sometimes also the women in the domestic setup seeing the sex workers and offering acts of solidarity to them. So again, a story of the sex workers are preparing to go on a long journey to protest in Delhi. And one of the wives of one of the Baloks came with lots of food to say, "Here's some food for you for your journey. You know, you're going to protest. This is a really good thing. And we want to show you our appreciation." And also the sheer relief for some of the women to have somebody else attending to the man's sexual needs, when actually what they want to get on with is, you know, looking after their children. I'm making it sound, it's a very complex thing and I don't want to oversimplify it. But I think we misread and misunderstand the nature of these kinds of relationships if we don't look at the subtleness and the stories and the detail of them. And rushing to an understanding that marriage is a good thing and that sex work is a bad thing, that sex workers are exploited and that married women are not exploited. There's a lot of stuff there that needs to be unpacked. And I think some of the features of these stories allow us to think much more critically. And as an anthropologist, to try and understand there about what are the relationships, what are the feelings, how do we compare that to ourselves, wherever we're from culturally, and how much of this can map onto, again, I think, women's relationships, especially heterosexual women's relationships with men in any context. Getting the nuance in there in a way in which I think some of the conventional narratives just don't.
Can we have you here on Making Sense, promising to publish this very soon?
I would like to do that. Now that I've got a bit more time, I'm looking forward to picking up the project with people. Yes, definitely.
So Andrea, beside your work on your teaching, your writing, you're also an administrator. And you have been for a while. What does managerial work involve in higher education in the UK, and how can you influence it?
Well, it's interesting because I think it very much depends on where you come from in terms of your management or political philosophy. So I got involved in being a senior manager as an anthropologist who was really interested in how my university worked and how power worked in the university. I was really interested in how do you change things. There were a couple of things that I thought were really, really unfair. And I saw an opportunity in becoming a university administrator to bring about changes in those things. When I became a head of school at Sussex, and being a head of school took me into spaces that I had never been in before with a completely different culture. And it was fascinating as an anthropologist to live in two different cultures in your own university, because I knew that that culture was there, the culture of the management space, the culture of the central administration. But I hadn't realised quite how different it was. And so as a kind of interlocutor or as a interloper, moving between the ordinary space, even with ordinary clothes on, and going into the management space and having to wear clothes that looked like other managers, otherwise I'd look out of place, and having to speak like other managers, otherwise I'd be out of place or be considered threatening or be considered an activist. And also as a woman, to even be heard. So I had to change my demeanour. I had to change the way in which I presented myself. I had to change the way I framed things. But I had to remember that I was doing it consciously, so that when I moved back into the space of the university, I didn't carry on using the same language and the same, I didn't appear in the same way. And that was really interesting as an anthropologist. It was like doing fieldwork in an episodic way, where you're doing it, you're going from your home into a space that's very strange. I never got used to the space, I have to say, the management space. So I regarded it as something that was, it was a curiosity, it was an anthropological curiosity. I was trying to understand power, I was trying to make change happen. But it wasn't my natural habitat. It was a space that was alienating lots of times. It was sometimes a space to laugh in, to play games in, not laugh in, but laugh about, because it was so strange, because strange things happened. And I think also in terms of management practice, something that's been really influential in my own practice has been my academic work on participation, empowerment, transparency, accountability. The work I've done looking at political philosophy and at radical democracy, and how concepts of from political philosophy about public space and about how people are able to act in public space, how people mobilise around demands. A lot of that has influenced my practice as a manager. And I think there's some really interesting things to be written and thought about as an anthropologist about how university administrators bring their disciplines into how they manage. So I've brought my academic interest in radical democracy into the way that I manage. I manage in a way, hopefully, I like to think of managing in a way where I open up information, I gather people together, I build community around things. That's certainly the way we managed to get such a good ref result, is that we did it as a team in a very inclusive way and worked together very effectively. If you come from a different kind of discipline, you might see power differently, you might see decision-making differently. And I think that's something that we don't talk about as university administrators. We just become, we're all managers, as if we're all coming from a similar disciplinary background or a similar persuasion in terms of management. I've also come to find management and leadership to be really interesting as in itself as something of anthropological inquiry. So how do you create leaders? How do you enable leaders? How do you facilitate the development of people? And how do you do that in a way where you're able with students, for example, to develop that as part of their experience of doing a degree, so that when they go out from their degree, they've got skills of facilitation, of listening, of engagement. They're confident about working with people. They've got a sense of their own leadership potential. Because one of the things that I've learned about leadership is it's about understanding yourself and the effect of you on other people and how people respond to you. And so again, as an academic, going now back into being an academic, I'm taking a lot of those lessons from what I've seen in the management space and be thinking about how to put them into my teaching practice and also into writing. And I'm looking forward to writing Confessions of an Anarchist Bureaucrat.
An ethnography of SARS Directorate. There's a question which I'd like to, which many academics ask behind closed doors. Academics are not trained leaders. You know, you become a reader or a professor, sometimes a senior lecturer, and you get an academic leadership role. Is it harmful not to be trained? Because sometimes it can be better not to be trained and have many possibilities, as you say. What do you think that, you know, should academics be trained in leadership, or should it be a more natural, more political, personal, moral position to take.
I think it's really interesting to think about what training. What do you mean by training?
The management training.
Yeah, management training. Yeah. So when I first became head of school, I said, I have to be trained. I don't know how to do this. But I had been a leader in other things that I'd done. But I was very obsessed with it for a while, that I needed to be sent on a training course, and the training course would tell me, and it would turn me into somebody who was able to do this thing. And I think what I've learned since about leadership development is that a lot of it's about reflecting on your own resources, on the effect you have on other people, on the things that you, it's kind of a lot of reflexivity. And you can't be trained in a kind of conventional sense in that. You can be trained in how to reflect more deeply. You can be trained in how to notice more the effects that you're having on other people. You can be trained in thinking about strategy, and so on. But I think every academic has the potential to become a leader. I think many academics are leaders without calling themselves leaders. I think one of the things...
all of us lead classrooms.
Exactly.
And large cohorts of students.
And we lead research projects. Okay. So I think, the question then is, which people who do the leadership in relation to research or in relation to teaching or in relation to impact become academic managers? And I think the more that those worlds are estranged from each other, the more that there's a sense that the managers are in a different culture, in a different zone, and the ordinary academics don't want to go into that zone. Something will happen to them if they go into that zone. They will never be able to come back if they go into that zone.
You're a good example of...
Break it down, because actually it means that you don't get a plurality of academics going into those jobs. And I think, that's not true, because you do get a range of academics going to those jobs, but it puts people off. So I don't know, it's interesting. I think it would be good for people to have more of a sense of what goes on in the management space, to open it up a bit more. And in that way, people might want to go back to what universities used to do, which is people do a stint in management and then they come back to being academics again, rather than it being seen as a career path in itself, which is estranging, which takes people out of their research, and then their research is damaged by it, and then they can't come back again, which sometimes people feel is the path, if they take that path.
We almost at the end of the show. I'd like to end this show by asking you about three books that have really influenced your work.
That's a really tough one, because there are so many things I've read. I think there's a novelist who's also a kind of an anthropologist called Zora Neale Hurston, and she wrote a book called Their Eyes Are Watching God that influenced me. I think also a really powerful book that I read when I was an anthropology student was called Death Without Weeping by Nancy Shepherd Hughes, about Brazil, and that was very influential. And I think Nelson Goodman, I referred to earlier, the idea that there are multiple ways of seeing the world, and that truths are true and versions are right for worlds they fit, I think it had a very profound effect on me, because I'd always questioned this idea that there was a single truth. I think an eclectic mix of literature and philosophy, and a little bit of anthropology.
Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Making Sense was produced by Andy Glenn. The recording was done at SOAS. If you have any thoughts or suggestions about the show, my email ID is sb127@soas.ac.uk. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening.